Thank you, Adil. Good morning, everybody. In early 2020, I think it would have been rather difficult for us to imagine how much would happen over the period of the pandemic. We all know its ravages. We know its personal ravages on individuals. We know what it's done professionally. So I don't need to report on that. We know that in the UK, in France, in Denmark, there's already a shift to relax lockdown restrictions. So the Europeans are throwing away their face masks. They're allowing better human social interaction, which is desperately needed, as we know, over the last 2 years. And in some quarters, there's a cautious return back to office. And I dare say reluctance on the part of employees to return back to the office. But the reality remains that we continue to live through a pandemic, and that's the reality of our current situation. In South Africa, by March of 2022, we'll be heading towards 730 days of the lockdown, and that is significant. None of us in all of our lives have ever experienced anything of the sort, but we have learned over the last 2 years how to regulate ourselves, how to regulate businesses, and how the human resilience needs to get back onto track so that we can continue with our lives. So what we intend to do is to cast our minds back. That whilst in 2020, in the beginning stages of 2020, after the initial lockdown, we explored extraordinary questions for businesses, for labor lawyers, for tax lawyers, for insurance lawyers, questions relating to the payment of salaries to employees during a hard lockdown. How is it to be managed? What was the laws around that? Determination of retirement fund rule amendments, questions relating to TERS, the tax implications relating to TERS. Was it salary? Was it benefits? What was it? The topics were endless. They never stopped. I could almost probably do a TikTok. No, I lie. I couldn't do a TikTok. My daughter could. On how lawyers had to answer questions in the beginning stages of the lockdown. And almost every answer was, I don't know. I don't know. Because we actually didn't know. Because there were no laws and we actually needed to find our feet in order to advise. And so it was so difficult for managers to run businesses as well. Fast forward to January of 2021. By then, we started exploring and debating the questions around mandatory vaccine policies. And I'm pleased to say that now in 2022, in the third year of this pandemic, we're able to focus a conversation with yourselves on somewhat more positive aspects, if there can be anything positive relating to COVID in the workplace. So with that having been said, it's a pleasure to introduce our panel that's going to look at these particular topics. We've got one employment lawyer, Khudisho Pashe, who's joining the panel, a legal tax specialist, Humaira Park, and a TMT lawyer, Apandile Govuza, who is going to delve into these topics with us. So, Khudisho, only because you're a labor lawyer and I've got a bias towards employment law, and because this has been facilitated by me as a labor lawyer, we obviously were strategic about this year. If it comes to a vote on anything, we vote together. So let's jump into it on an employment topic. If we reflect on 2021, the Disaster Management Act, there were numerous regulations that were issued over the period of the lockdown that related specifically to the workplace. Before we jump and get into the hot topic about mandatory vaccine policies, perhaps if you can just have an initial conversation with us in relation to what sort of disputes had come before the CCMA and various bargaining councils across the country, and the nature of forms of disputes that employees were facing in their workplaces and had to be determined by arbitrators.
Thank you, Imran. And once again, morning to all of our clients, colleagues, and attendees. Yeah, Imran, that's actually a good question. And as you've been saying, obviously, with something as unprecedented as COVID-19, we started seeing new trends in cases that were being referred to the CCMA, and the relevant bargaining councils. And having reviewed the COVID-19 disputes in the past 2 years, I'd say that there were three predominant grounds for dismissal. And these grounds were mainly related to COVID, and they had to do with absenteeism, insubordination, and obviously the hot topic of them all being the breach of COVID-19 protocols. And those are basically the most predominant grounds.
So keep me honest on this one, Khadisha. On breach of COVID protocols, it appears that the CCMA adopted a zero tolerance to it. An employee breached COVID regulations when it came to an employer's workplace, that was the end of it. No first warning, no second warning, no progressive discipline. You got the axe.
Definitely.
That'd be a fair assessment.
Definitely that. The CCMA actually took a strong stance in that regard, because as its main objective really is to ensure that there is fairness for both employers and employees. The CCMA actually looked at what rules were actually there, and they looked at whether the rules were reasonable and whether the employees were aware of such rules and whether the rules were consistently applied and if dismissal was an appropriate sanction. And to be honest with you, in an instance where we have a pandemic and we have individuals or rather employees who fail to follow the necessary protocols, the CCMA had to take a strong stance against it. And Imran, something as interesting as having a case, like for instance, the popular case of Skhosana and Total, where a petrol attendant was dismissed for failure to wear a mask. Yeah. And in essence, it's one of those things that we always go back to: was the rule reasonable? Right, and the CCMA looks at that as yes, the rule is reasonable because we're going through a pandemic. So that is one of the examples of matters where the CCMA blatantly expressed that it would not condone any sort of recklessness in the workplace.
And then perhaps before we get to the topic of mandatory vaccines, let's just touch on absenteeism. As recent as I think it was Monday that government issued a new change in relation to the isolation periods. There's obviously a possibility that employees may now self-quarantine, isolate themselves in accordance with what the laws were prior to the amendments of last week. Any tips for employers relating to that aspect and what arises from case law over the last 2 years, and particularly last year on absenteeism?
Yeah, no, thanks for that. And I think that's a very important change that employers should know and notify the employees. So our government has issued new regulations in terms of isolation and has decreased the period of isolation from 10 days to 7 days. Now, that's a drastic change for employers, if you actually think about it, because now if your employees are not aware of such a thing and they either test positive or they are exposed to someone, they need to know that the isolation period is 7 days. And again, going back to, is the rule known or is the rule reasonable? Was the employees aware? This is also something that employers must take upon themselves to notify the employees, because it's going to come back and we need to say that, no, we actually did communicate this. And it's very interesting how absenteeism during COVID was such a hot topic, as we've seen in case law that employees would just not come to work, and there was various reasons. Some of the reasons were employees were just afraid of COVID-19, as we all were in the beginning. We did not know what it was, how it affects you, and how it may affect you and your family. So, but then on the other hand, we had borderline cases and cases on the other side where employees were just being unreasonable. As a startup, in the case of Beck and Palmer, this is an important one. An employee was dismissed for failing to come to work for 21 days. Now, take into consideration, this was during the log 5 lockdown.
Right.
The employee had requested leave, even unpaid leave from the employer, because she feared to infect her family. And she mentioned, she brought up grounds that she had vulnerable employee, vulnerable family members and children with asthma. And although the employer at the time had 16 other employees, it refused to consider the applicant's individual circumstances. Now, again, this was level lockdown 5, right, when everyone did not know. Now, the commissioner deplored this approach and found that the dismissal was unfair as the employer's requirements were unreasonable. So again, the CCMA does want employers to at least attempt to see how we can accommodate our employees. Now, on the other hand, we have the case of Skhosana and Arrows Mining, where the applicant in this instance was way less fortunate than the previous one. He was a miner, and along with several others, were sent home to isolate after a colleague had tested positive for COVID-19. Now, the manager told them to go home and isolate, and thereafter, after 10 days, they should return. After the 10 days, the manager telephoned the employee, and the employee said he was not feeling well. The employee was requested to take a COVID test. He failed to do so and still did not come back to work. So now there you see how he refused to take the COVID-19 test and still refused to come back to work. That's a clear case of absenteeism. And the commission resolved that the dismissal had been fair, as it was improbable that the applicant did not know that he had to come back to work after 10 days.
I guess the takeaway point from that is what the earlier point that you were making. Ensure that the rule is known to employees. So even with the change in the law in the last week, it's important or imperative that companies make the new law known to employees and what the position is, so that there's no confusion and employee can't rely upon that in order to avoid any liability if insurer arises. I guess that becomes the takeaway point.
Yeah, no, definitely correct. And that's what the code of conduct of the CCMA really even encourages, that you make the rule known, make it reasonable. Yeah.
Awesome. So then let's get onto the hot topic. So as I was driving into the office today, 94.7, that very rarely ever talks about anything serious on the breakfast show, because one would expect some casual conversation in the morning. Was having a debate about mandatory vaccines. So I mean, I thought, let's listen to this. It's very interesting. So let's frame this conversation correctly. In January or February of last year, when we had this discussion on this platform, I remember the debate we were having, because there was no law around it. So we were saying, well, if the law was to be, where would it likely go? But in the instance where we don't have a law on a mandatory vaccine, what is our views in relation to how to manage it, with reference to constitutional provisions, et cetera, et cetera. But come June of last year, with the consolidated directives that were issued, we now have a law under the Disaster Management Act by way of the regulations, where the Minister of Employment and Labour says, well, within your own workplace, you're entitled to have a mandatory vaccine policy. So we all know that anybody that enters this debate must have a mandatory vaccine policy. In the absence of that, there's no conversation. We know that the two bases under the directive that allows for exemptions, we know them. The one is religious, the other is medical incapacity. We don't need to get into the detail around that. We've discussed it. The law is reasonably clear in relation to that. But what employers are currently beginning to see, Khadisho, let's have a discussion around those issues. Yeah. Employees who are saying, well, I can't make out a case in respect of the exemption for religious reason, or I don't have a medical justification not to be vaccinated. What are the forms of debates or objection that employees are now raising that you're coming across?
Yeah, thanks for that, Imran. So what we're looking at now is is a we're looking at a space where we don't have any laws yet, and there isn't really much to lean back on. Now, some of the grounds that we see in our employment spaces and our case law that's coming out through the CCMA is that employees are really looking at their right to bodily integrity, and which again, they look at the Constitution and just are trying to work out how do mandatory vaccination balance, or how are they limited, or how can the Constitution limit those? So we're seeing a lot of those where they're claiming the right to freedom and relying on the Constitution. And on the other hand, you said there's also religious exemptions where we have employees who come and say that their religion or whatever belief they subscribe to does not allow for vaccinations, and because it hasn't been tested, which for the few cases we have in the CCMA, the employees really struggle to bring up any evidence of the religious exemption and how, whether there's any Scientology or theological basis of such an exemption. So we're looking at those aspects now, which are a bit difficult to really maneuver.
So I've come across a number of objections by employees simply on the basis that, well, because there's no law, no general law of application on mandatory vaccine, that, well, it's my choice. And for an employer that has a policy in place, well, then there's some difficulty with that argument, because if you start out the argument on the premise, my body, my choice, your employer takes the position, it's my business, my rules. So the policy is the starting point. In the absence of a policy, any employer would have difficulty in relation to rolling out a mandatory vaccine policy. So that's the one aspect of it. So I'm finding that argument arising quite often. And the other, where employees are saying, well, this is an experimental drug. Whether it's the vaccine that comes through Johnson & Johnson, whether it's a vaccine that comes through Pfizer, whether it's a vaccine that comes from Sputnik or wherever else, it's all experimental. Therefore, I refuse to be vaccinated. And that too, there's limitations to that argument. So we've come across a number of organizations that are kind of pushing an anti, I'm hesitant to call it an anti-vax approach in the context of COVID. But let's call it that for want of a better term. But there are a number of organizations that are doing that. Just talk us through some of them that you've come across.
Yeah. So, and what you're mentioning is indeed very, very serious, Imran, because one thing that I will say, and I strongly agree with what you're saying, that if you do not have a mandatory vaccination policy, which was implemented through a risk assessment, then there shouldn't even be a consideration of getting your employees to vaccinate or forcing them to vaccinate. So that's where it starts. And I think a very important thing that we see in our consolidated directive is that it's very clear in that every employer must undertake a risk assessment and taking into account the operational requirements of the workplace, then it must decide if it intends to implement that. So that's just the point of departure with that. Now, as for the organizations which are really seeking to not have either their members or employees vaccinated, we've seen a lot. And at the forefront, as an employment lawyer, I'll tell you that trade unions are on the forefront of this, as their natural mandate is to protect the employment security of their members, and when it comes to COVID-related dismissals, we see COSATU, FEDUSA, NACTU, who are very vocal about job losses. And however, as Ardo mentioned in the beginning, Solidarity has been the most active trade union in the courts in this regard, as there's currently a an application before the High Court in the Free State, and the application is basically challenging the implementation of a mandatory vaccination policy at the University of the Free State, and there's multiple factors to which they object to. A few being that a risk assessment was not successfully undertaken, no vulnerable employees were identified. They basically challenge that the assessment has been generalized, that there's no details in terms of how the policy will achieve the objectives. So those are the organizations we're seeing, and some others being Pandemic Data Analytics. The HBR Foundation has been one of them, which represents those who's been dismissed for refusing to be vaccinated. So we are not short of organizations or people on the other side that are fighting for vaccines not to be mandated.
So I guess the point at the bottom of it, and probably well made in relation to the Solidarity and University of Free State case that you're referring to, is an attack on the policy. So it gets back to the initial point. If an employer doesn't have a mandatory vaccine policy in place, well, there's no discussion. And that's where it kind of starts and ends. So in order to get into the debate, you need the mandatory vaccine policy and then to allow the process to unfold from there. So let's Horisho, pivot away from that. Humaira, you know, the old adage that whilst the world changes, there's two constants, and the one is tax and the other one is death, was very true in the beginning of 2020 with this pandemic. So whilst we were all over the show trying to work out what the world was saying, the one thing that was certain was that we were going to pay taxes. Let's turn to a discussion around this concept of remote working. The forcing workers into a remote environment and allowing a large portion, or at least a segment of the workforce, to work from a remote location, like from your home, has kind of had some benefits for individual taxpayers. So what are the considerations which employers, you would say, ought to bear in mind in respect of employees who work remotely?
So Ron, there's nothing really that an employer has to do. So an employer must simply continue to adhere to its employees withholding tax duties as it would have in the ordinary course. What happened over the past 2 years is a lot of attention was drawn to the question of whether employees were capable of claiming a deduction of expenses that they were incurring from now working from home. And so, you know, the Income Tax Act provides that, you know, the in principle position is that employees are entirely precluded from claiming any deduction that relates to employment from their income. So that's the general position. There is, however, an exception to this, and that's based on the duration of time that an employee spends outside of the office. So, you know, just in essence, what the exemption provides is that if employees have a home office that is fully equipped with everything that they need in order for them to perform their functions at the office, and that home office is regularly and exclusively used for purposes of their employment, they could be eligible to claim a deduction, provided that where they are normal employees, just, you know, simply either remuneration or director's fees, they spend more than 50% of their working time in a particular year of assessment working from that home office, or if they earn the majority of their income, which is more than 50% of their income, from a commission-based, either commission-based or performance-based income, then they need to spend more than 50% of the year of assessment. Their working time needs to be anywhere outside of the office. But again, just to go back to your question, that really has nothing to do with the employer. It's really for the employee to claim the deduction in their personal income tax return. And the most that an employer can do is educate their employees. You know, it does make for happier employees if they are able to claim a refund from SARS. You know, employees generally, unlike juristic entities, we have very limited scope to try and reduce our taxable income. It's simply deducted from our salaries. And, you know, employees could potentially provide staff with a letter confirming the duration that they work from home, because that is one of the documentation that's requested by SARS. And then I think the third thing, and this is, you know, actually a request by SARS, because SARS has over the past 2 years been very conscious of the fact that there could be a substantial loss to the fiscus if a lot of employees claim a deduction. And so they've published a lot of media statements, etc., to this effect. But one of the things that they've said is that these expenses really must relate to the construct of the home office, and not be, for example, data, stationary, cleaning, and all of that. That should rather be reimbursed by the employer, and then the employer claim the deduction. And, you know, from a deductibility perspective for employer, it's far more likely that they'd be able to achieve it. So entirely discretionary at the instance of the employer, but those are the three inputs that they could give.
Okay, so effectively it's quite nuanced, and it really boils down to individual circumstances. And the confirmation from an employer of the work office is important for the purposes of SARS. And if there's any form of dishonesty, fraud there, well, it potentially exposes both the employer and the employee, I would assume, the taxpayer in their personal capacity, plus the employer, or that not be so.
It wouldn't be so unless, you know, there's some sort of misrepresentation on the part of the employer in relation to, for example, the duration that the employee spent at home. So really it comes down, the onus of proof in claiming a deduction sits exclusively in this instance with the employee, because it's their individual tax return.
So would you have any particular tax tips for employees that work from home?
So I would say, you know, definitely ensure that you meet the requirement. Make sure that you meet the 50% requirement. If you can get a letter from your employer, that would be excellent, if the employer is willing to provide that. Make sure that you have a home office that is regularly and exclusively used for work purposes. SARS has been quite explicit on the fact that, you know, you can't use your dining room table. It has to, you know, in essence, they want an office in your home. Make sure that you keep all your documentation. Extremely important. SARS is auditing a lot of employees, you know, after they claim a deduction. And then also be cognizant of the fact that if you claim a home office expense deduction at the time that you sell your home, if you actually own your home, at the time that you sell it, that portion of your home that constitutes the home office will not be subject to the capital gains tax 2 million exemption that individuals normally get when they sell their home. So there is a disadvantage, and SARS is punting that disadvantage quite heavily to discourage employees from claiming the deduction.
Yes, thank you, Humaira, for giving with one hand and taking with the other, as the receivers know what to do. So I certainly didn't know about the budget in relation to the sale of your residence. That's an important consideration, I guess, for anybody that plays in that space and wants a deduction. So just moving away from the issue of tax for a moment, Apanjile, if we can get you into the conversation. The hybrid work environment, where employees now work both remotely from home and at the office, creates some issues in relation to data protection for companies and employers. We saw Poppy come into full effect last year, so we don't obviously need to get into the details around that. We're all quite familiar with it. But what would you say is an important or significant area relating to data protection that employers must take into account when it comes to this hybrid work environment going forward?
Yeah, thanks for that, Imran, and hi colleagues, and hi to all the participants and clients. So I think a good place to start, Imran, is when you speak of data protection, you know, that we all casually say this, and we speak of data protection and we speak of personal information and things else, but just a second to just explain what that actually means. So really, this is an expression really of the right to privacy,
when it pertains to the protection of information about both a living natural person as well as a juristic person. And I pause here for a bit to emphasize this a bit. Reason being that most of the times when people think of personal information, they only think of information that relates to a natural person, individuals such as you and I. But the way PUPI, the Protection of Personal Information Act, defines personal information, which is unique to South Africa, I must add, it relates to both living natural persons, such as you and I, as well as juristic persons that are companies. And the protection really applies equally to both these individuals as well as companies. So I'll pause there for a bit and explain what personal information actually means. And most of the times this is also confused as information that's sensitive, but really the way that personal information is defined in the legislation is really any information that can be used in order to identify a natural person and a juristic person. So it doesn't have to be one's ID number or one's cell phone number. It's really any information that can be used either on its own or in combination with other information for purposes of identifying a person, natural or juristic. Moving on now to the question that you were asking, Imran, which is what aspect of data protection would I like to bring to everybody's attention on the webinar? I think the most important issue is the issue of security, right? And the idea being that what is it that an employer needs to do as employees are increasingly moving to working from home? Now, I think before we start speaking about what it is that an employer can do, we need to first look at what's required by the legislation. So the law says if you're an employer, which you are what's called the responsible party, you are required to implement what's called appropriate, reasonable, technical and organizational measures, and these must have the effect of preventing loss, unlawful access to data, as well as unauthorized destruction of data. Now, curiously enough, the legislation doesn't tell you exactly what it is that you need to do in order to protect the information. All that it says is you must take into account generally acceptable information security practices, take into account the industry in which you're practicing in, and most importantly, the type of information that you're processing. So depending on the level of sensitivity of the type of information that you're processing, the measures that you do put in place for purposes of protecting that information from unauthorized access, they may differ. Now, when employees are working from the office, naturally, there's security at the gate, there's access control, there's all sorts of protections that are put in place in order to ensure that any information that's being processed by the company is protected. But when employees move outside of those walls, outside of those buildings and working from their home, then there becomes a certain level of risk and some exposure when it comes to the data that they process. And I think the most important thing at this stage is to speak of data breaches, right? So it's a lot harder for any information that's being processed by an employer to be exposed to data breach when it's happening from the office. It can happen, but it's a lot harder because there are measures that have been put in place, and it's easy to prove these in the event that the information regulator comes knocking. But it's a lot different when an employee works from home. There's more exposure, there's likely no security, there's likely no locked doors in order to protect the information that they process. Sometimes employees are working from their counter and everybody has access to their laptops, to the data that they're processing, to the documents that they process, and so on. Now, what can you do as an employer in order to ensure that you implement some reasonable measures to for purposes of protecting this information? Now, like I said, the law doesn't specifically tell you what it is that you need to do, but through practice, we've seen some of the measures that employers are implementing, that they put in place in order to ensure that the information that's being processed by employees using sometimes their personal equipment, their personal laptops, and sometimes laptops of their employers. So one of the things that you can do, you can encrypt and install firewalls on all the devices that your employees are using. And employees should be requested to install security patches and update endpoints. You can require security access clearance to couple systems, such as VPN restriction system access to specific networks via the device that's being used. You can install remote collaboration safeguards, install licensed security enterprise level conferencing, and collaboration tools such as MS Teams.
But can I just come in there? So from what I'm gathering, you're saying, is with the advent of Poppy comes all these obligations, and you're speaking about a lot of practical IT related issues that need to be implemented. Would you say it's fair that old IT policies properly need to be updated in order to give effect to Poppy, number one, and to a hybrid work environment in relation to what employees can and cannot do with access to the service remotely?
I think absolutely, Imran. I think absolutely. But I think even before we get to the development and implementation of policies and updating existing policies, I think the most critical thing is actually training. Now, not only is it practical to train your employees as to what it is that they can or cannot do, not do insofar as data is concerned, it's also a requirement in terms of Poppy, in terms of the regulations related to Poppy, that employers actually have an obligation to conduct regular internal awareness sessions regarding the provisions of Poppy, as well as its regulations. So you have an obligation as an employer to carry out training and conduct training to ensure that your employees know what it is they need to do with information. And then once you've done that, you also have an obligation, which would then be part of the training, to then update your policies, develop new policies where none are in place, and socialize all of those policies throughout the organization to ensure that employees know exactly what it is they need to do insofar as data is concerned.
So perhaps let's round off the conversation, because we are running out of time. Just on a final topic, Ndile, the liability for a company where there is a data breach, or what is that liability? And in your experience, over the last couple of years, where's the vulnerability been for companies in relation to data breaches?
Yeah, I think the critical important point, Emir, and I think what I want to point out at this stage is what a data breach actually is. So when one thinks of a data breach, they think of this big, you know, leak of information that's been exposed to hundreds and hundreds of people. But the way that it's been defined under the legislation, it's really any unauthorized access to data that you process. Which, if you think about it, and it sounds a little bit ridiculous, if I'm sitting in my office at home and my wife walks in and she picks at a document that I'm working on, that, in terms of the legislation, would constitute data breach. And as soon as that actually happens, that triggers some obligations on you as an employer, as what's called the responsible party, to comply with the law. And as soon as a data breach happens, you are then required to notify that breach to both the information regulators as well as the data subjects, unless you don't have access to those. And one cannot begin to imagine the nightmare that is the admin relating to this, the notifications, the press releases, managing, you know, perceptions and reputational damage that attaches to these. And most importantly, if you are found wanting, if the information regulator finds that you didn't do what you were supposed to do, there could be fines that could be issued for your failure to comply with the law. This could go up to 10 million, and there could be some imprisonment as well for those involved in failing to do what they're supposed to do. So the consequences are dire.
Yeah. So perhaps we should end on that point then, Apendile, before we pass on to the next speaker. I guess what employers need to be cognizant of is a remote work environment does come with risk in relation to something like data breaches and cybersecurity, whilst it comes with lots of benefits as well. And the question of POPI compliance is going to become more important as, I don't want to say as the years go by, but as the months go by. And this is going to be no different to ensuring compliance with competition laws, because non-compliance is going to have, it's going to come with serious risks to business. Would that be a fair assessment on that one?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think most importantly, when the information regulator comes knocking, what they'll want to see is the record of the training that you've provided to your employees and the policies that you've implemented. That's what we'll save you.
Okay. Well, with that, I'm going to say thank you very much, Apandile. That was very useful. Humaira, thank you for, as usual, with text taking from the left and giving to the right. Some of those points were very useful. I think the audience, for especially in relation to employees who are claiming deductions, need to be alive to those issues. Hudisho, when I see you down the passage later this morning, we'll debate more about vaccine mandates, and as we have another day of battles ahead with employees who are refusing to be vaccinated. Thank you for your input around this. It was very, very useful. Thank you very much.